Raymond, the turncloaks, went Sir John Tollett and Sir Simon Crane. The fifth Kingsguard, Sir Harold Langwood, demanded a trial by battle. Jaehaerys granted his wish and offered to face Sir Harold himself in single combat, but in this he was overruled by the Queen Regent. Instead, a young knight from the Stormlands was sent forth as the Crown's champion. Sir Giles Morrigan, the man chosen, was a nephew to Daemon the Devout, the grand captain of the Warrior's Sons who had led them in their Trial of Seven against Maegor. Eager to prove his house's loyalty to the new king, Sir Giles made short work of the elderly Sir Harold, and was named Lord Commander of Jaehaerys's Kingsguard soon after. Meanwhile, word of the prince's clemency spread throughout the realm. One by one, the remainder of King Maegor's adherents dismissed their hosts, left their castles, and made the journey to King's Landing to swear fealty. Some did so reluctantly, fearing that Jaehaerys might prove to be as weak and feckless a king as his father. But as Maegor had left no heirs of the body, there was no plausible rival around whom opposition might gather. Even the most fervent of Maegor's supporters were won over once they met Jaehaerys, for he was all a prince should be, fair-spoken, open-handed, and as chivalrous as he was courageous. Grand Maester Benefer, newly returned from his self-imposed exile in Pentos, wrote that he was learned as a maester and pious as a septon. And whilst some of that may be discounted as flattery, there was truth to it as well. Even his mother, Queen Alyssa, is reported to have called Jaehaerys the best of my three sons. It must not be thought that the reconciliation of the lords brought peace to Westeros overnight. King Maegor's efforts to exterminate the poor fellows and the warrior's sons had set many pious men and women against him and against House Targaryen. Whilst he had collected the heads of hundreds of stars and swords, hundreds more remained at large, and tens of thousands of lesser lords, landed knights, and small folk sheltered them, fed them, and gave them aid and comfort wherever they could. Ragged Silas and Dennis the Lame commanded roving bands of poor fellows who came and went like wraiths, vanishing into the greenwood whenever threatened. North of the Golden Tooth, the Red Dog of the Hills, Sir Geoffrey Doggett, moved between the Westerlands and Riverlands at will, with the support and connivance of Lady Lucinda, the pious wife of the Lord of Riverrun. Sir Geoffrey, who had taken upon himself the mantle of the Grand Captain of the Warrior's Sons, had announced his intention to restore that once proud order to its former glory, and was recruiting knights to its banners. Yet the greatest threat was in the south, where Septon Moon and his followers camped beneath the walls of Oldtown, defended by Lord Oakheart and Lord Rowan and their knights. A massive hulk of a man, Moon had been blessed with a thunderous voice and an imposing physical presence. Though his poor fellows had proclaimed him the true High Septon, this Septon, if indeed he was such, was no picture of piety. He boasted proudly that the Seven-Pointed Star was the only book he had ever read. And many questioned even that, for he had never been known to quote from that holy tome, and no man had ever seen him read nor write. Barefoot, bearded, and possessed of immense fervour, the poorest fellow could speak for hours, and often did. And what he spoke about was sin. "I am a sinner," were the words with which Septon Moon began every sermon, and so he was. A creature of immense appetites, a glutton and a drunkard renowned for his lechery, Moon lay each night with a different woman, impregnating so many of them that his acolytes began to say that his seed could make a barren woman fertile. Such was the ignorance and folly of his followers that this tale became widely believed. Husbands began to offer him their wives, and mothers their daughters. Septon Moon never refused such offers, and after a time, some of the hedge knights and men-at-arms amongst his rabble began to paint images of the Cock of the Moon on their shields, and a brisk trade grew up in clubs, pendants, and staffs carved to resemble Moon's member. A touch with the head of these talismans was believed to bestow prosperity and good fortune. Every day Septon Moon went forth to denounce the sins of House Targaryen and the lickspittle who permitted their abominations, whilst inside Oldtown, the true father of the faithful had become a virtual prisoner in his own palace. unable to set forth outside the confines of the starry sept. Though Lord Hightower had closed his gates against Septon Moon and his followers, and refused to allow them entrance to his city, he showed no eagerness to take up arms against them, despite repeated entreaties from His High Holiness. When pressed for reasons, his lordship cited a distaste for shedding pious blood, but many claimed the real reason was his unwillingness to offer battle to Lords Oakheart and Rowan, who had granted Moon their protection. His reluctance earned him the name Lord Donald the Delayer from the Maesters of the Citadel. The long conflict between King Maegor and the Faith had made it imperative that Jaehaerys be anointed king by the High Septon, Lord Rhaegar and the Queen Regent agreed. Before that could happen, however, Septon Moon and his ragged horde must needs be dealt with, so the prince could travel safely to Old Town. It had been hoped that the news of Maegor's death would be sufficient to persuade Moon's followers to disperse, and some had done just that, but no more than a few hundred in a host that numbered close to 5,000. "What can the death of one dragon matter when another rises up to take its place?" Septon Moon declared to his throng. "Westeros will not be clean again until all the Targaryens have been slain or driven back into the sea." Every day he preached anew, calling upon Lord Hightower to deliver Old Town to him, calling upon the High Lickspittle to leave the Starry Sept and face the wrath of the poor fellows he had betrayed, calling upon the small folk of the realm to rise up. And every night he sinned anew. Across the realm in King's Landing, Jaehaerys and his counsellors considered how to rid the realm of this scourge. The boy king and his sisters, Rhaena and Alysanne, all had dragons, and some felt the best way to deal with Septon Moon was the way Aegon the Conqueror and his sisters had dealt with the two kings on the Field of Fire. Jaehaerys had no taste for such slaughter, however, and his mother, Queen Alyssa, flatly forbade it, reminding them of the fate of Rhaenys Targaryen and her dragon in Dawn. Lord Rhaegar, the king's hand, said with some reluctance that he would lead his own host across the Reach and disperse Moon's men by force of arms, though it would mean pitting his Stormlanders and whatever other forces he might gather against Lords Rowan and Oakheart and their knights and men-at-arms, as well as the poor fellows. "Like as not, we will win," the Protector said, "but not without cost." Mayhaps the gods were listening. For even as the king and council argued in King's Landing, the problem was resolved in a most unexpected way. Dusk was falling outside of Old Town when Septon Moon retired to his tent for his evening meal, exhausted by a day of preaching. As always, he was guarded by his poor fellows, huge strapping axemen with unshorn beards, but when a comely young woman presented herself at the Septon's tent with a flagon of wine that she wished to give to His Holiness in return for his help, they admitted her at once. They knew what sort of help the woman required, the sort that would put a babe inside her belly. A short time passed, during which the men outside the tent heard only occasional gusts of laughter from Septon Moon inside. But then, suddenly, there was a groan and a woman's shriek, followed by a bellow of rage. The tent flap was thrown open, and the woman burst out, half-naked and barefoot, and dashed away, wide-eyed and terrified, before any of the poor fellows could think to stop her. Septon Moon himself followed a moment later, naked, roaring, and drenched in blood. He was holding his neck, and blood was leaking between his fingers and dripping down into his beard from where his throat had been slit open. It is said that Moon staggered through half the camp, lurching from campfire to campfire in pursuit of the doxy who had cut him. Finally, even his great strength failed him. He collapsed and died as his acolytes pressed around him, wailing their grief. Of his slayer there was no sign. She had vanished into the night, never to be seen again. Angry poor fellows tore the camp apart for a day and a night in search of her, knocking over tents, seizing dozens of women, and beating any man who tried to stand in their way. But the hunt came up empty. Septon Moon's own guards could not even agree on what his killer had looked like. The guards did recall that the woman had brought a flagon of wine with her as a gift for the Septon. Half the wine still remained in the flagon when the tent was searched, and four of the poor fellows shared it as the sun was coming up, after carrying the corpse of their prophet back to his own bed. All four were dead before noon. The wine had been laced with poison. In the aftermath of Moon's death, the ragged host that he had led to Old Town began to disintegrate. Some of his followers had already slipped away when word of King Magor's death and Prince Jaehaerys's ascension reached them. Now that trickle became a flood. Before the Septon's corpse had even begun to stink, a dozen rivals had come forward to claim his mantle, and fights began to break out amongst their respective followers. It might have been thought that Moon's men would turn to the two lords amongst them for leadership, but nothing could be further from the truth. The poor fellows, especially, were no respecters of nobility, and the reluctance of Lords Rowan and Oakheart to commit their knights and men-at-arms to an assault on the walls of Old Town had made them suspicious of the two lords. The possession of Moon's mortal remains became itself a bone of contention between two of his would-be successors, the poor fellow known as Rob the Starveling, and a certain Lorcus, called Lorcus the Learned, who boasted of having committed all of the Seven-Pointed Star to memory. Lorcus claimed to have had a vision that Moon would yet deliver Old Town into the hands of his followers even after death. After seizing the Septon's body from Rob the Starveling, this learned fool strapped it atop a destrier, naked, bloody, and rotting, to storm the gates of Old Town. Fewer than 100 men joined in the attack, however, and most of them died beneath a rain of arrows, spears, and stones before they got within 100 yards of the city walls. Those who did reach the walls were drenched in boiling oil or set afire with burning pitch, Lorcus the Learned himself amongst them. When all his men were dead or dying, a dozen of Lord Hightower's boldest knights rode forth from a sally port, seized Septon Moon's body, and removed his head. Tanned and stuffed, it would later be presented to the High Septon in the Starry Sept as a gift. The abortive attack proved to be the last gasp of Septon Moon's crusade. Lord Rowan decamped within the hour with all his knights and men-at-arms. Lord Oakheart followed the next day. The remainder of the host, hedge knights and poor fellows and camp followers and tradesmen, streamed away in all directions, looting and pillaging every farm, village, and holdfast in their path as they went. Fewer than 400 remained of the 5,000 that Septon Moon had brought to Old Town when Lord Donald the Delayer at last bestirred himself and rode forth in force to slaughter the stragglers. Moon's murder removed the last major obstacle to the accession of Jaehaerys Targaryen to the Iron Throne, but from that day to this, debate has raged as to who was responsible for his death. No one truly believed that the woman who attempted to poison the sinful Septon and ended by cutting his throat was acting on her own. Plainly, she was but a cat's paw. But whose? Did the boy king himself send her forth, or was she mayhaps an agent of his hand, Rhaegar Baratheon, or his mother, the Queen Regent? Some came to believe that the woman was one of the Faceless Men, the infamous guild of sorcerer assassins from Braavos. In support of this claim, they cited her sudden disappearance, the way she seemed to melt into the night after the murder, and the fact that Septon Moon's guards could not agree on what she looked like. Wiser men and those more familiar with the ways of the Faceless Men give this theory little credence. The very clumsiness of Moon's murder speaks against it being their work, for the Faceless Men take great care to make their killings appear as natural deaths. It is a point of pride with them, the very cornerstone of their art. Slitting a man's throat and leaving him to stagger forth into the night screaming of murder is beneath them. Most scholars today believe that the killer was no more than a camp follower, acting at the behest of either Lord Rowan or Lord Oakheart, or mayhaps the both of them. Though neither dared desert Moon whilst he lived, the alacrity with which the two lords abandoned his cause after his death suggests that their grievance had been with Maegor, not with House Targaryen. And indeed, both men would soon return to Old Town, penitent and obedient, to bend the knee before Prince Jaehaerys at his coronation. With the way to Old Town clear and safe once more, that coronation took place in the Starry Sept in the waning days of the 48th year after the conquest. The High Septon, the High Lickspittle that Septon Moon had hoped to displace, anointed the young king himself, and placed his father Aenys's crown upon his head. 7 days of feasting followed, during which hundreds of lords, great and small, came to bend their knees and swear their swords to Jaehaerys. Amongst those in attendance were his sisters, Rhaena and Alysanne, his young nieces, Arya and Rhaella, his mother, the Queen Regent Alyssa, the King's Hand, Rhaegar Baratheon, Sir Giles Morrigan, the Lord Commander of the Kingsguard, Grand Maester Bennifer, the assembled Arch-Maesters of the Citadel. And one man no one could have expected to see. Sir Geoffrey Doggett, the Red Dog of the Hills, self-proclaimed Grand Captain of the outlawed Warrior's Sons. Doggett had arrived in the company of Lord and Lady Tully of Riverrun, not in chains, as most might have expected, but with a safe conduct bearing the King's own seal. Grand Maester Bennifer wrote afterward that the meeting between the boy king and the outlaw knight set the table for all of Jaehaerys's reign to follow. When Sir Geoffrey and Lady Lucinda urged him to undo his uncle Maegor's decrees and reinstate the swords and stars, Jaehaerys refused firmly. "The faith has no need of swords," he declared. "They have my protection, the protection of the Iron Throne." He did, however, rescind the bounties that Maegor had promised for the heads of Warrior's Sons and Poor Fellows. "I shall not wage war against my own people," he said, "but neither shall I tolerate treason and rebellion." "I rose against your uncle just as you did," replied the Red Dog of the Hills, defiant. "You did," Jaehaerys allowed, "and you fought bravely. No man can deny. The Warrior's Sons are no more, and your vows to them are at an end, but your service need not be. I have a place for you." And with these words, the young king shocked the court by offering Sir Geoffrey a place by his side as a knight of the King's Guard. A hush fell then, Grand Maester Bennifer tells us, and when the Red Dog drew his long sword, there were some who feared he might be about to attack the king with it. But instead the knight went to one knee, bowed his head, and laid his blade at Jaehaerys's feet. It is said that there were tears upon his cheeks. 9 days after the coronation, the young king departed Old Town for King's Landing. Most of his court travelled with him in what became a grand pageant across the Reach. But his sister Rhaena stayed with them only as far as Highgarden, where she mounted her dragon Dreamfire to return to Fair Isle and Lord Farman's castle above the sea, taking her leave not only of the king, but of her daughters. Rhaella, a novice sworn to the faith, had remained at the Starry Sept, whilst her twin, Arya, continued on with the king to the Red Keep, where she was to serve as a cup-bearer and companion to the princess, Alysanne. Yet a curious thing befell Queen Rhaena's girls after the king's coronation, it was observed. The twins had ever been mirror images of each other in appearance, but not in temperament. Whereas Rhaella was said to be a bold and wilful child and a terror to the scepters who had been given charge of her, Arya had been known as a shy, timid creature, much given to tears and fears. "She is frightened of horses, dogs, boys with loud voices, men with beards and dancing, and she is terrified of dragons," Grand Maester Bennifer wrote when Arya first came to court. That was before Maegor's fall and Jaehaerys's coronation, however. Afterward, the girl who remained at Old Town devoted herself to prayer and study, and never again required chastisement, whereas the girl who returned to King's Landing proved to be lively, quick-witted, and adventurous, and was soon spending half her days in the kennels, the stables, and the dragon yards. Though nothing was ever proved, it was widely believed that someone, Queen Rhaena herself mayhaps, or her mother, Queen Alyssa, had used the occasion of the king's coronation to switch the twins. If so, no one was inclined to question the deception, for until such time as Jaehaerys sired an heir of the body, Princess Arya, or the girl who now bore that name, was the heir to the Iron Throne. All reports agree that the king's return from Old Town to King's Landing was a triumph. So Geoffrey rode by his side, and all along the route they were hailed by cheering throngs. Here and there, poor fellows appeared, gaunt, unwashed fellows with long beards and great axes, to beg for the same clemency that had been granted the Red Dog. This Jaehaerys granted them on the condition that they agreed to journey north and join the Night's Watch at the Wall. Hundreds swore to do so, amongst them no less a personage than Rob the Starveling. "Within a moon's turn of being crowned," Grand Maester Benefer wrote, "King Jaehaerys had reconciled the Iron Throne to the faith and put an end to the bloodshed that had troubled the reigns of his uncle and father." The Year of the Three Brides, 49 AC. The 49th year after Aegon's conquest gave the people of Westeros a welcome respite from the chaos and conflict that had gone before. It would be a year of peace, plenty, and marriage, remembered in the annals of the Seven Kingdoms as the Year of the Three Brides. The new year was but a fortnight old when news of the first of the three weddings came out of the west, from Fair Isle by the Sunset Sea. There, in a small, swift ceremony under the sky, Rhaena Targaryen wed Andro Farman, the second son of the Lord of Fair Isle. It was the groom's first marriage, the bride's third. Though twice widowed, Rhaena was but 26. Her new husband, just 10 and 7, was notably younger, a comely and amiable youth said to be utterly besotted with his new wife. Their wedding was presided over by the groom's father, Mark Farman, Lord of Fair Isle, and conducted by his own septon. Lyman Lannister, Lord of Casterly Rock, and his wife Jocasta were the only great lords in attendance. Two of Rhaena's former favourites, Samantha Stokeworth and Alain Royce, made their way to Fair Isle in some haste to stand with the widowed queen, together with the groom's high-spirited sister, the Lady Alyssa. The remainder of the guests were bannermen and household knights, sworn to either House Farman or House Lannister. King and court remained entirely ignorant of the marriage, until a raven from the rock brought word days after the wedding feast and the bedding that sealed the match. Chroniclers in King's Landing report that Queen Alyssa was deeply offended by her exclusion from her daughter's wedding, and that relations between mother and child were never as warm afterward, whereas Lord Rhaegar Baratheon was furious that Rhaena had dared remarry without the crown's leave, the crown in this instance being himself, as the young king's hand. Had leave been asked, however, there was no certainty it would have been granted, for Andro Farman, the second son of a minor lord, was thought by many to be far from worthy of the hand of a woman who had been twice a queen and remained the mother of the king's heir. As it happened, the youngest of Lord Rhaegar's brothers remained unwed as of 49 AC, and his lordship had two nephews by another brother, who were also of a suitable age and lineage to be considered potential mates for a Targaryen widow. Facts which might well explain both the hand's anger and the secrecy with which Queen Rhaena wed. King Jaehaerys himself and his sister Alysanne rejoiced at the tidings, dispatching gifts and congratulations to Fair Isle, and commanding that the Red Keep's bells be rung in celebration. Whilst Rhaena Targaryen was celebrating her marriage on Fair Isle, back in King's Landing, King Jaehaerys and his mother, the Queen Regent, were busy selecting the councillors who would help them rule the realm for the next 2 years. Conciliation remained their guiding principle, for the divisions that had so recently torn Westeros apart were far from healed. Rewarding his own loyalists and excluding Maegor's men and the faithful from power would only exacerbate the wounds and give rise to new grievances, the young king reasoned. His mother agreed. Accordingly, Jaehaerys reached out to the Lord of Claw Isle, Edwell Celtigar, who had been Hand of the King under Maegor, and recalled him to King's Landing to serve as Lord Treasurer and Master of Coin. For Lord Admiral and Master of Ships, the young king turned to his uncle, Daemon Valerian, Lord of the Tides, Queen Alyssa's brother, and one of the first great lords to abandon Maegor the Cruel. Prentice Tully, Lord of Riverrun, was summoned to court to serve as Master of Laws. With him came his redoubtable wife, the Lady Lucinda, far famed for her piety. Command of the City Watch, the largest armed force in King's Landing, the king entrusted to Carl Corbray, Lord of Heart's Home, who had fought beside Aegon the Uncrowned beneath the God's Eye. Above them all stood Rhaegar Baratheon, Lord of Storm's End and Hand of the King. It would be a mistake to underestimate the influence of Jaehaerys Targaryen himself during the years of his regency, for despite his youth, the boy king had a seat at most every council, but not all, as will be told shortly, and was never shy about letting his voice be heard. In the end, however, the final authority throughout this period rested with his mother, the Queen Regent, and the Hand, a redoubtable man in his own right. Blue-eyed and black-bearded and muscled like a bull, Lord Rogar was the eldest of five brothers, all grandsons of Orys One-Hand, the first Baratheon lord of Storm's End. Orys had been a bastard brother to Aegon the Conqueror, and his most trusted commander. After slaying Argilac the Arrogant, last of the Durrandon, he had taken Argilac's daughter to wife. Lord Rogar could thus claim that both the blood of the dragon and that of the Storm Kings of old flowed in his veins. No swordsman, his lordship preferred to wield a double-bladed axe in battle. An axe, he oft said, large and heavy enough to cleave through a dragon's skull. Those were dangerous words during the reign of Maegor the Cruel. But if Rogar Baratheon feared Maegor's wrath, he hid it well. Men who knew him were unsurprised when he gave shelter to Queen Alyssa and her children after their flight from King's Landing, and when he was the first to proclaim Prince Jaehaerys king. His own brother Boris was heard to say that Rogar dreamed of facing King Maegor in single combat and cutting him down with his axe. That dream fate denied him. Instead of a kingslayer, Lord Rogar became a kingmaker, delivering to Prince Jaehaerys the Iron Throne. Few questioned his right to take his place at the side of the young king as Hand. Some went so far as to whisper that it would be Rogar Baratheon who ruled the realm henceforth, for Jaehaerys was a boy and the son of a weak father, whilst his mother was only a woman. And when it was announced that Lord Rogar and Queen Alyssa were to marry, the whispers grew louder. For what is a queen's lord husband, if not a king? Lord Rogar had been married once before, but his wife had died young, taken off by a fever less than a year after their wedding. The Queen Regent Alyssa was 42 years old and thought to be past her childbearing years, the Lord of Storm's End 10 years her junior. Writing some years later, Septon Barth tells us that Jaehaerys was opposed to the marriage. The young king felt that his Hand was overreaching himself, motivated more by a desire for power and position than a true affection for his mother. He was angry that neither his mother nor her suitor had sought his leave as well, Barth said. But as he had raised no objections to his sister's marriage, the king did not believe he had the right to prevent his mother's. Jaehaerys thus held his tongue, and gave no hint of his misgivings, save to a few close confidants. The Hand was admired for his courage, respected for his strength, feared for his military prowess and skill at arms. The Queen Regent was loved. So beautiful, so brave, so tragic, women said of her. Even such lords as might have balked at a woman ruling over them were willing to accept her as their liege, secure in the knowledge that she had Rogar Baratheon standing beside her, and the young king less than a year away from his 16th name day. She had been a beautiful child, all men agreed, the daughter of the mighty Aethon Valerian, Lord of the Tides, and his lady wife Alara of House Massey. Her line was ancient, proud and rich, her mother esteemed as a great beauty, her grandsire amongst the oldest and closest friends of Aegon the Dragon and his queens. The gods blessed Alyssa herself with the deep purple eyes and shining silvery hair of old Valyria, and gave her charm and wit and kindness as well, and as she grew, suitors flocked around her from every corner of the realm. There was never any true question of whom she would wed, however. For a girl such as her, only royalty would suffice, and in the year 22 AC she married Prince Aenys Targaryen, the unquestioned heir to the Iron Throne. Theirs was a happy and fruitful marriage. Prince Aenys was a gentle and attentive husband, warm-natured, generous, and never unfaithful. Alyssa bore him 5 strong, healthy children, 2 daughters and 3 sons. A 6th child, another daughter, died in her cradle shortly after birth. And when his sire died in 37 AC, the crowd passed to Aenys, and Alyssa became his queen. In the years that followed, she saw her husband's reign crumble and turn to ash as enemies rose up all around him. In 42 AC he died, a broken man and despised, only 5 and 30 years of age. The queen scarce had time to grieve for him, before his brother seized the throne that rightly belonged to her eldest son. She saw her son rise up against his uncle and die, together with his dragon. A short while later, her second son followed him to the funeral pyre, tortured to death by Tyana of the Tower. Together with her two youngest children, Alyssa was made a prisoner in all but name of the man who had brought about the death of her sons, and was made to bear witness when her eldest daughter was forced into marriage to that same monster. The Game of Thrones takes many a queer turn, however, and Maegor himself had fallen in turn, in no small part thanks to the courage of the widowed Queen Alyssa, and the boldness of Lord Rhaegar, who had befriended her and taken her in when no one else would. The gods had been good to them, and granted them victory, and now the woman who had been Alyssa of House Valerian was to be given a second chance at happiness with a new husband. The wedding of the King's Hand and the Queen Regent was to be as splendid as that of the widowed Queen Rhaena had been modest. The High Septon himself would perform the marriage rites on the 7th day of the 7th moon of the new year. The site would be the half-completed dragon pit, still open to the sky, whose rising tiers of stone benches would allow for tens of thousands to observe the nuptials. The celebrations would include a great tourney, 7 days of feasts and frolics, and even a mock sea battle to be fought in the waters of Blackwater Bay. No wedding half so magnificent had been celebrated in Westeros in living memory, and lords great and small from throughout the Seven Kingdoms and beyond gathered to be part of it. Donal Hightower came up from Oldtown with 100 knights and 77 of the most devout, escorting His High Holiness the High Septon, whilst Lyman Lannister brought 300 knights from Casterly Rock. Brandon Stark, the ailing Lord of Winterfell, made the long journey down from the north with his sons Walton and Alaric, attended by a dozen fierce northern bannermen and 30 sworn brothers of the Night's Watch. Lords Arryn, Corbray, and Royce represented the Vale, Lords Selmy, Dondarrion, and Tarly, the Dornish Marches. Even from beyond the borders of the realm the great and mighty came, the Prince of Dawn sent his sister, the Sea Lord of Braavos, a son. The Archon of Tyrosh crossed the narrow sea himself with his maiden daughter, as did no fewer than 22 magisters from the free city of Pentos. All brought handsome gifts to bestow on the Hand and Queen Regent. The most lavish came from those who had only lately been Maegor's men, and from Rickard Rowan and Torgon Oakheart, who had marched with Septon Moon. The wedding guests came ostensibly to celebrate the union of Rhaegar Baratheon and the Dowager Queen, but they had other reasons for attendance, it should not be doubted. Many wished to treat with the Hand, who was seen by many as the true power in the realm. Others wished to take the measure of their new boy king. Nor did His Grace deny them that opportunity. Sir Giles Morrigan, the king's champion and sworn shield, announced that Jaehaerys would be pleased to grant audience to any lord or landed knight who wished to meet with him, and 60 accepted his invitation. Eschewing the great hall and the majesty of the Iron Throne, the young king entertained the lords in the intimacy of his solar, attended only by Sir Giles, a maester, and a few servants. There, it is said, he encouraged each man to speak freely and share his views on the problems of the realm and how they might best be overcome. "He is not his father's son," Lord Royce told his maester afterward, grudging praise, mayhaps, but praise all the same. Lord Vance of Wayfarer's Rest was heard to say, "He listens well, but says little." Rickard Rowan found Jaehaerys gentle and soft-spoken. Kyle Connington thought him witty and good-humoured. Morton Caron, cautious and shrewd. "He laughs often and freely, even at himself," John Mertens said approvingly. But Alec Hunter thought him stern, and Torgon Oakheart grim. Lord Malister pronounced him wise beyond his years, whilst Lord Darry said he promised to be the sort of king any lord should be proud to kneel to. The most profound praise came from Brandon Stark, Lord of Winterfell, who said, "I see his grandsire in him." The King's Hand attended none of these audiences, but it should not be thought that Lord Rhaegar was an inattentive host. The hours his lordship spent with his guests were devoted to other pursuits, however. He hunted with them, hawked with them, gambled with them, feasted with them, and drank the royal cellars dry. After the wedding, when the tourney began, Lord Rogar was present for every tilt and every melee, surrounded by a lively and oft-drunken coterie of great lords and famous knights. The most notorious of his lordship's entertainments occurred 2 days before the ceremony, however. Though no record of it exists in any court chronicle, tales told by servants and repeated for many years thereafter amongst the small folk claim that Lord Rogar's brothers had brought 7 virgins across the narrow sea from the finest pleasure houses of Lys. Queen Elissa had surrendered her own maidenhood many years before to Aenys Targaryen, so there could be no question of Lord Rogar deflowering her on their wedding night. The Lycene maidens were meant to make up for that lack. If the whispers heard about court afterward were true, his lordship supposedly plucked the flowers of 4 of the girls before exhaustion and drink did him in. His brothers, nephews, and friends did for the other 3, along with 20 older beauties who had sailed with them from Lys. Whilst the hand roistered, and King Jaehaerys sat in audience with the lords of the realm, his sister, Princess Alysanne, entertained the high-born women who had come with them to King's Landing. The king's elder sister, Rhaena, had chosen not to attend the nuptials, preferring to remain on Fair Isle with her own new husband and her court, and the queen regent, Alysa, was busy with preparations for the wedding, so the task of playing hostess to the wives, daughters, and sisters of the great and mighty fell to Alysanne. Though she had only recently turned 13, the young princess rose to the challenge brilliantly, all agreed. For 7 days and 7 nights she broke her fast with 1 group of high-born ladies, dined with a 2nd, supped with a 3rd. She showed them the wonders of the Red Keep, sailed with them on Blackwater Bay, and rode with them about the city. Alysanne Targaryen, the youngest child of King Aenys and Queen Elissa, had been little known amongst the lords and ladies of the realm before then. Her childhood had been spent in the shadow of her brothers and her elder sister Rhaena, and when she was spoken of at all, it was as the little maid and the other daughter. She was little, this was true. Slim and slight of frame, Alysanne was oft described as pretty, but seldom as beautiful, though she was born of a house renowned for beauty. Her eyes were blue rather than purple, her hair a mass of honey-coloured curls. No man ever questioned her wits. Later it would be said of her that she learned to read before she was weaned, and the court fool would make japes about little Alysanne dribbling mother's milk on Valyrian scrolls as she tried to read whilst suckling at her wet nurse's teat. Had she been a boy, she would surely have been sent to the citadel to forge a maester's chain, Septon Bath would say of her. For that, wise man esteemed her even more than her husband, whom he served for so long. That was far in the future, however. In 49 AC, Alysanne was but a girl of 13 years, yet all the chronicles agree that she made a powerful impression on those who met her. When the day of the wedding finally arrived, more than 40,000 small folk ascended the Hill of Rhaenys to the Dragon Pit to bear witness to the union of the Queen Regent and the Hand. Some observers put the count even higher. Thousands more cheered Lord Rogar and Queen Elissa in the streets as their procession made its way across the city, attended by hundreds of knights on caparisoned palfreys and columns of scepters ringing bells. "Never has there been such a glory in all the annals of Westeros," wrote Grand Maester Bennifer. Lord Rogar was clad head to heel in cloth of gold beneath an antlered half-helm, whilst his bride wore a great cloak sparkling with gemstones, with a 3-headed dragon of House Targaryen and the silver seahorse of the Valyrians facing one another on a divided field. Yet for all the splendour of the bride and groom, it was the arrival of Elissa's children that set King's Landing to talking for years to come. King Jaehaerys and Princess Alysanne were the last to appear, descending from a bright sky on their dragons Vermithor and Silverwing. The Dragon Pit still lacked the great dome that would be its crowning glory, it must be recalled, their great leathern wings stirring up clouds of sand as they came down side by side, to the awe and terror of the gathered multitudes. The oft-told tale that the arrival of the dragons caused the aged High Septon to soil his robes is likely only a calumny. Of the ceremony itself, and the feast and bedding that followed in due course, we need say little. The Red Keep's cavernous throne room hosted the greatest of the lords and the most distinguished of the visitors from across the sea. Lesser lords, together with their knights and men-at-arms, celebrated in the yards and smaller halls of the castle, whilst the small folk of King's Landing made merry in 100 inns, wine-sinks, pot-shops, and brothels. Notwithstanding his purported exertions 2 nights prior, it is reliably reported that Lord Rogar performed his husbandly duties with vigour, cheered on by his drunken brothers. 7 days of tourney followed the wedding and kept the gathered lords and the people of the city enthralled. The tilts were as hard-fought and thrilling as had been seen in Westeros in many a year, all agreed, but it was the battles fought afoot, with sword and spear and axe, that truly excited the passions of the crowd on this occasion, and for good reason. It will be recalled that 3 of the 7 knights who served as Maegor the Cruel's Kingsguard were dead. The remaining 4 had been sent to the Wall to take the Black. In their places, King Jaehaerys had thus far named only Sir Giles Morrigan and Sir Joffrey Doggett. It was the Queen Regent, Alyssa, who first put forward the idea that the remaining 5 vacancies be filled through test of arms. And what better occasion for it than the wedding, when knights from all over the realm would gather? Maegor had old men, lickspittles, cravens and brutes about him, she declared. I want the knights protecting my son to be the finest to be found anywhere in Westeros, true, honest men whose loyalty and courage is unquestioned. Let them win their cloaks with deeds of arms, whilst all the realm looks on. King Jaehaerys was quick to second his mother's notion, but with a practical twist of his own. Sagely, the young king decreed that his would-be protectors should prove their prowess afoot, not in the joust. Men who would do harm to their king seldom attack on horseback with lance in hand, his grace declared. And so it was that the tilts that followed his mother's wedding yielded pride of place to the wild melees and bloody duels the maesters would dub the War for the White Cloaks. With hundreds of knights eager to compete for the honour of serving in the King's Guard, the combats lasted 7 full days. Several of the more colourful competitors became favourites of the small folk, who cheered them raucously each time they fought. One such was the drunken knight Sir Willem Stafford, a short, stout, big-bellied man who always appeared so intoxicated that it was a wonder he could stand, let alone fight. The commons named him the Kegger Ale, and sang, "Hail, hail, Kegger Ale," whenever he took the field. Another favourite of the commons was the bard of Fleabottom, Tom the Strummer, who mocked his foes with ribald songs before each bout. The slender mystery knight, known only as the Serpent in Scarlet, also had a great following. When finally defeated and unmasked, he proved to be a woman, Jonquil Dark, a bastard daughter of the Lord of Duskendale. In the end, none of these would earn a white cloak. The knights who did, though less madcap, proved themselves second to none in valour, chivalry, and skill at arms. Only one was the scion of a lordly house, Sir Lawrence Roxton from the Reach. 2 were sworn swords, Sir Victor the Valiant from the household of Lord Royce of Runestone, and Sir Willem the Wasp, who served Lord Smallwood of Acorn Hall. The youngest champion, Pate the Woodcock, fought with a spear instead of a sword, and some questioned whether he was a knight at all, but he proved so skilful with his chosen weapon that Sir Geoffrey Doggett settled the matter by dubbing the lad himself, whilst hundreds cheered. The eldest champion was a grizzled hedge knight named Samgood of Sour Hill, a scarred and battered man of 63, who claimed to have fought in 100 battles. "And never you mind on what side, that's for me and the gods to know." One-eyed, bald and almost toothless, the knight called Sour Sam looked as gaunt as a fence-post. But in battle he displayed the quickness of a man half his age, and a vicious skill honed through long decades of battles, great and small. Jaehaerys the Conciliator would sit the Iron Throne for 55 years, and many a knight would wear a white cloak in his service during that long reign, more than any other monarch could boast. But it was rightly said that never did any Targaryen possess a king's guard who could equal the boy king's first 7. The War for the White Cloaks marked the end of the festivities of what soon became known as the golden wedding. As the visitors took their leaves to wend their way home to their own lands and keeps, all agreed that it had been a magnificent event. The young king had won the admiration and affection of many lords, both great and small, and their sisters, wives, and daughters had only praise for the warmth shown them by Princess Alysanne. The small folk of King's Landing were pleased as well. Their boy king seemed to have every sign of being a just, merciful, and chivalrous ruler, and his hand, Lord Rhogar, was as open-handed as he was bold in battle. Happiest of all were the city's innkeepers, taverners, brewers, merchants, cut-purses, whores, and brothel-keepers, all of whom had profited mightily from the coin the visitors brought to the city. Yet, though the golden wedding was the most lavish and far-famed of the nuptials of 49 AC, the third of the marriages made in that fateful year would prove to be the most significant. With their own wedding now safely behind them, the Queen Regent and the King's Hand next turned their attention to finding a suitable match for King Jaehaerys, and to a lesser extent for his sister, Princess Alysanne. So long as the boy king remained unwed and without issue, the daughters of his sister Rhaena would remain his heirs, but Arya and Rhaela were still children, and it was felt by many manifestly unfit for the crown. Moreover, Lord Rhogar and Queen Alysa both feared what might befall the realm should Rhaena Targaryen return from the west to act as regent for a daughter. Though none dared speak of it, it was plain that discord had arisen between the two queens, for the daughter had neither attended her mother's wedding nor invited her to her own. And there were some who went further and whispered that Rhaena was a sorceress, who had used the dark arts to murder Maegor upon the Iron Throne. Therefore it was incumbent upon King Jaehaerys to marry and beget a son as soon as possible. The question of who the young king might marry was less easily resolved. Lord Rhogar, who was known to harbour thoughts of extending the power of the Iron Throne across the Narrow Sea to Essos, put forward the notion of forging an alliance with Tyrosh by wedding Jaehaerys to the Archon's daughter, a comely girl of 15 years who had charmed all at the wedding with her wit, her flirtatious manner, and her blue-green hair. In this, however, his lordship found himself opposed by his own wife, Queen Alysa. The small folk of Westeros would never accept a foreign girl with dyed tresses as their queen, she argued, no matter how delightful her accent. And the pious would oppose the girl bitterly, for it was known that the Tyroshi kept not the Seven, but worshipped Red R'hllor, the Pattern Maker, Three-Headed Trios, and other queer gods. Her own preference was to look to the houses who had risen in support of Aegon the Uncrowned in the battle beneath the god's eye. Let Jaehaerys wed a Vance, a Corbray, a Westerling, or a Piper, she urged. Loyalty should be rewarded, and by making such a match the king would honour Aegon's memory and the valour of those who fought and died for him. It was Grand Maester Benefer who spoke loudest against such a course, pointing out that the sincerity of their commitment to peace and reconciliation might be doubted if they were seen to favour those who had fought for Aegon over those who had remained with Maegor. A better choice, he felt, would be a daughter of one of the great houses that had taken little or no part in the battles between uncle and nephew, a Tyrell, a Hightower, an Arryn. With the king's hand, the queen regent and the grand maester so divided, other councillors felt emboldened to put forward candidates of their own. Prentice Tully, the royal justiciar, nominated a younger sister of his own wife, Lucinda, famed for her piety. Such a choice would surely please the faith. Daemon Valerian, the Lord Admiral, suggested that Jaehaerys might marry the widowed Queen Eleanor of House Costain. How better to show that Maegor's supporters had been forgiven than by taking one of his black brides to Queen, mayhaps even adopting her three sons by her first marriage. Queen Eleanor's proven fertility was another point in her favour, he argued. Lord Celtigar had two unwed daughters and had famously offered Maegor his choice of them. Now he offered the same girls again for Jaehaerys. Lord Baratheon was having none of it. "I have seen your daughters," Rhogar said to Celtigar. "They have no chins, no teats, and no sense." The Queen Regent and her councillors discussed the question of the king's marriage time and time again over most of a moon's turn, but came no closer to reaching a consensus. Jaehaerys himself was not privy to these debates. On this, Queen Alysa and Lord Rhogar agreed. Though Jaehaerys might well be wise beyond his years, he was still a boy, and ruled by a boy's desires. Desires that on no account could be allowed to overrule the good of the realm. Queen Alyssa, in particular, had no doubt whatsoever about whom her son would choose to marry, were the choice left to him. Her youngest daughter, his sister, the Princess Alysanne. The Targaryens had been marrying brother to sister for centuries, of course, and Jaehaerys and Alysanne had grown up expecting to wed, just as their elder siblings Aegon and Rhaena had. Moreover, Alysanne was only 2 years younger than her brother, and the two children had always been close and strong in their affection and regard for one another. Their father, King Aenys, would certainly have wished for them to marry, and once that would have been their mother's wish as well. But the horrors she had witnessed since her husband's death had persuaded Queen Alyssa to think elsewise. Though the warriors' sons and poor fellows had been disbanded and outlawed, many former members of both orders remained at large in the realm, and might well take up their swords again if provoked. The Queen Regent feared their wrath, for she had vivid memories of all that had befallen her son Aegon and her daughter Rhaena when their marriage was announced. "We dare not ride that road again," she is reported to have said more than once. In this resolve she was supported by the newest member of the court, Septon Mateus, of the Most Devout, who had remained in King's Landing when the High Septon and the rest of his brethren returned to Oldtown. A great whale of a man, as famed for his corpulence as for the magnificence of his robes, Mateus claimed descent from the Gardener kings of old, who had once ruled the Reach from their seat at Highgarden. Many regarded him as a near certainty to be chosen as the next High Septon. The present occupant of that holy office, whom Septon Moon had derided as the High Lickspittle, was cautious and complacent, so there was little to no danger of any marriage being denounced from Oldtown so long as he continued to speak for the Seven from his seat in the Starry Sept. The Father of the Faithful was not a young man, however. The journey to King's Landing to officiate at the Golden Wedding had almost been the end of him, Man said. "If it should fall to me to don his mantle, his grace, of course, would have my support in any choice he might make," Septon Mateus assured the Queen Regent and her advisers. "But not all of my brethren are so inclined, and, dare I say, there are other moons out there. Given all that has occurred, to marry brother to sister at this juncture would be seen as a grievous affront to the pious, and I fear for what might happen." Their queen's misgivings thus confirmed, Rhaegar Baratheon and the other lords put aside all consideration of Princess Alysanne as a bride for her brother Jaehaerys. The princess was 3 and 10 years of age, and had recently celebrated her first flowering, so it was thought desirable to see her wed as soon as possible. Though still far apart as regarded a suitable match for the king, the council settled swiftly on a partner for the princess. She would be married on the 7th day of the new year to Orin Baratheon, the youngest of Lord Rhaegar's brothers. Thus it was settled by the Queen Regent and the king's hand, and their lords, councillors, and advisers. But like many such arrangements through the ages, their plan was soon undone, for they had grievously underestimated the will and determination of Alysanne Targaryen herself, and her young king, Jaehaerys. No announcement had yet been made of Alysanne's betrothal, so it is not known how word of the decision reached her ears. Grand Maester Bennifer suspected a servant, for many such had come and gone whilst the lords debated in the queen's solar. Lord Rhaegar himself was suspicious of Daemon Valerian, the Lord Admiral, a prideful man who might well have believed that the Baratheons were overreaching themselves in hopes of displacing the Lords of the Tide as the second house in the realm. Years later, when these events had passed into legend, the small folk would tell each other that rats in the walls had overheard the lords talking and rushed to the princess with the news. No record survives of what Alysanne Targaryen said or thought when first she learned that she was to be wed to a youth 10 years her senior, whom she scarcely knew and, if rumour can be believed, did not like. We know only what she did. Another girl might have wept, or raged, or run pleading to her mother. In many a sad song, maidens forced to wed against their will throw themselves from tall towers to their deaths. Princess Alysanne did none of these things. Instead, she went directly to Jaehaerys. The young king was as displeased as his sister at the news. "They will be making raiding plans for me as well, I do not doubt," he deduced at once. Like his sister, Jaehaerys did not waste time with reproaches, recriminations, or appeals. Instead, he acted. Summoning his king's guard, he instructed them to sail at once for Dragonstone, where he would meet them shortly. "You have sworn me your swords and your obedience," he reminded his seven. "Remember those vows, and speak no word of my departure." That night, under cover of darkness, King Jaehaerys and Princess Alysanne mounted their dragons Vermithor and Silverwing and departed the Red Keep for the ancient Targaryen citadel below the Dragonmont. Reportedly, the first words the young king spoke upon landing were, "I have need of a septon." The king, rightly, had no trust in Septon Mateus, who would surely have betrayed their plans, but the sept on Dragonstone was tended by an old man named Oswick, who had known Jaehaerys and Alysanne since their births, and instructed them in the mysteries of the Seven throughout their childhood. As a younger man, Septon Oswick had ministered to King Aenys, and as a boy, he had served as a novice in the court of Queen Rhaenys. He was more than familiar with the Targaryen tradition of sibling marriage, and when he heard the king's command, he assented at once. The king's guard arrived from King's Landing by galley a few days later. The following morning, as the sun rose, Jaehaerys Targaryen, the first of his name, took to wife his sister Alysanne in the great yard at Dragonstone, before the eyes of gods and men and dragons. Septon Oswick performed the marriage rites. Though the old man's voice was thin and tremulous, no part of the ceremony was neglected. The seven knights of the king's guard stood witness to the union, their white cloaks snapping in the wind. The castle's garrison and servants looked on as well, together with a good part of the small folk of the fishing village that huddled below Dragonstone's mighty curtain walls. A modest feast followed the ceremony, and many toasts were drunk to the health of the boy king and his new queen. Afterward, Jaehaerys and Alysanne retired to the bedchamber where Aegon the Conqueror had once slept beside his sister Rhaenys. But in view of the bride's youth, there was no bedding ceremony, and the marriage was not consummated. That omission would prove to be of great importance when Lord Rhaegar and Queen Alyssa arrived belatedly from King's Landing in a war galley, accompanied by a dozen knights, 40 men-at-arms, Septon Mateus, and Grand Maester Bennifer, whose letters give us the most complete accounting of what transpired. Jaehaerys and Alysanne met them inside the castle gates, holding hands. It is said that Queen Alyssa wept when she saw them. "You foolish children," she said, "you know not what you've done." Then up spoke Septon Mateus, his voice thunderous as he berated the king and queen and prophesied that this abomination would once more plunge all of Westeros into war. "They shall curse your incest from the Dornish marches to the wall, and every pious son of the mother and the father shall denounce you as the sinners you are." The Septon's face grew red and swollen as he raved, Bennifer tells us, and spittle sprayed from his lips. Jaehaerys, the conciliator, is rightly honoured in the annals of the Seven Kingdoms for his calm demeanour and even temper. But let no man think that the fire of the Targaryens did not burn in his veins. He showed it then. When Septon Mateus finally paused for a breath, the king said, "I will accept chastisement from Her Grace, my mother, but not from you. Hold your tongue, fat man. If another word passes your lips, I will have them sewn shut." Septon Mateus spoke no more. Lord Rhaegar was not so easily cowed. Blunt and to the point, he asked only if the marriage had been consummated. "Tell me true, Your Grace, was there a bedding? Did you claim her maidenhead?" "No," the king replied, "she is too young." At that, Lord Rhaegar smiled. "Good! You are not wed." He turned to the knights who had accompanied him from King's Landing. "Separate these children, gently if you please. Escort the princess to Sea Dragon Tower and keep her there. His Grace shall accompany us back to the Red Keep." But as his men moved forward, the seven knights of Jaehaerys's King's Guard stepped up and drew their swords. "Come no closer," warned Ser Giles Morrigan. "Any man who lays a hand upon our king and queen shall die today." Lord Rhaegar was dismayed. "Sheathe your steel and move aside," he commanded. "Have you forgotten? I am the king's hand." "Aye," old Sour Sam answered, "but we're the king's guard, not the hand."